FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today's 8/22/18. Well, we're hearing about trade wars. We're hearing about all sorts of wild things going on, and it's bad for the economy. It's bad for you. It's bad for the country. It's bad for the world. But lately, it looks like statistics are showing otherwise. And if it matters to you, which it should, well, you'll hear from Michael Stumo, CEO of the Coalition for a Prosperous America. Hey, but in the meantime, as always, join the discussion. Email us. The email address is kl@kerrylutz.com. Hey, we'll read your questions on the air and maybe even have you on the show. So kl@kerrylutz.com. So in the meantime, what's really happening with the so-called trade war? Well, Michael Stumo, you're an expert in this. You represent a bipartisan coalition of farmers, ranchers, manufacturers, and other interested parties working to help eliminate the trade deficit and create good-paying jobs in America. So welcome back. And hey, lots going on, huh?
Hi, Kerry. Yeah, it's great to be here. It's pretty busy this week. We've got 6 days of hearings going on right now in Washington because the U.S. Trade Representative's office is in the process of imposing tariffs on an additional $200 billion of Chinese imports. And the president, because these tariffs are to cause China to change its behavior on its persistent commercial espionage, its technology theft. And China, instead of changing from past tariffs, has retaliated against fairly traded goods. So the president wants to up the pressure from 10% to 25% on this $200 billion in goods. And we've submitted comments and support. But we're finding from the tariffs already implemented that there's a far larger job creation going on by protecting our industries from foreign predation. Far more job creation than job destruction. In fact, it's 20 to 1 as far as jobs actually created. We found there's 11,100 jobs created directly tied to the tariffs, and there's only 514 jobs lost directly tied to the tariffs. So that's stark contrast to the free trade globalist economist economic model predictions.
So how did the free traders get it so wrong, or did they even care?
You know, there's a collective insanity among the free trade globalist economists in the media that everything is about cheap consumer prices, comparative advantage among countries, and efficiency. All that sounds really good, but the real game is about growing your national productive capacity and employment, because the job and wage gain is more important than any marginal loss for cheap imported consumer price, which a lot of times the consumer doesn't see anyway. So the point is they're cheap consumer price and efficiency focused, and the game for winning the global war for good jobs and industries, the game is to build your productive capacity and good paying jobs.
Hey, and somehow Trump figured this out, and none of these geniuses who've been running our trade policy, running our foreign policy, none of them got this all these years?
Well, sure. Trump has been on this for 30 years, pre-Ross Perot days, and others do, but you can't get tenured as an economics professor if you don't toe the sort of comparative advantage free trade efficiency line. They dismiss you. You're an idiot. You're not going to get tenure. You won't get published. As we've seen in the media, if you say something other than the gospel on free trade, you are mocked. And so Trump is the only one, people have thought about, Trump's the only one who's really broken through. And now we're going to have new data from the U.S. on what the result of tariff and trade intervention is. We've seen positive results from China, Japan, and Korea when they did it. Now we'll see how we did it, and it's going to break all the economic models, and they'll have to rewrite the Econ 101 textbooks.
So what about retaliation? Obviously, we've got the largest trade deficit, so anything we do to bring it down, the U.S. is a winner, right?
Right. Well, what we're really seeing is a job quality increase. Unfortunately, we're seeing a trade deficit increase this year, but that's because the dollar is getting even more overvalued because our economy is doing well. These other countries are not. Plus, when Turkey, Russia, Argentina, Venezuela fail, capital flight goes from their countries to the safe harbor of the U.S., makes our dollar high, makes our goods and services more expensive. And we've been working pretty hard to get the administration focused additionally on the overvalued dollar, which is like an export tax for our stuff and an import subsidy for others. So that's a big deal. But the quality of employment, the jobs coming back are high quality jobs. They're not Frappuccino flippers. Frappuccino servers.
Yeah.
Burger flippers. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, whatever, but marginal minimum wage type jobs. But look, Obama told us these jobs were never coming back. How could they get it so wrong?
Yeah. Again, it's a collective insanity among the ruling class. And Hank Paulson, who was Bush's Treasury Secretary, Tim Geithner and Jack Lew, who were Obama's Treasury Secretaries, all those folks were drinking from the same globalist Kool-Aid. They just have a different view of the dynamics of how the world works, and they're just wrong. We've got to go, Alexander Hamilton had it right. He rejected the free trade model. Frederick List followed, who was a German economist, followed Hamilton, and he built the Germany from a collection of, city-states to, a superpower. And then Japan, China, and Korea did it, too. So it's the only way it ever works.
Yeah, so the idea that somehow we're going to trade our way out of the malaise and the empty factories, the shuttered factories, has been stood on its head. When are they going to admit, or are they going to ever admit, that they had it wrong?
Yeah, old failed theories never die. It's just only their adherents die.
Yeah, well.
Then something else takes its place with a new adherence. I think that's what we'll see here. But this debate is 200 years old. It goes back to, the early 1800s with Alexander Hamilton dismissed Adam Smith as a cosmopolitan economist. Ricardo convinced Britain to go from its mercantilism to free trade, which was fine when they ruled the world, but then the upstarts surpassed them with a strategic trade, i.e. the U.S. and Germany. And now China's doing it with us. But this debate has gone on a long time. And the U.S. abided by a strategic trade American system of economics until the Great Depression and post-World War II, when we became free traders as the biggest economy in the world. That's not how we got there.
Yeah. But there's a balance, right? Because if you go too much into protectionism, then really genuinely inefficient industries get subsidized effectively,
right?
And they just buy back shares or increase the CEO's bonuses. I mean, is it really a good thing that U.S. Steel is expanding when they've proven themselves totally inept before and they gave up their leadership in the industry by not investing in technology, by rampant unionism, all of these things? So where's the balance here is what I'm asking.
Sure. No, that's a great question. And we're really talking about trade and industrial strategy. And with laissez-faire globalist free trade, we just don't admit industrial and trade strategy exist. Okay. But that's the real politic. That's how countries grow. But as you allude to, you can screw it up. For example, we don't want to, necessarily have, duffel bag sewing coming back. That's not necessarily where we want to be. Steel is a little bit different. I mean, Nucor is a well-run steel company. U.S. Steel, some think it's not. But it's not just limited to U.S. Steel. There's Nucor, there's Banker Steel, there's, you know, United Steel, there's Inframetals, there's a lot of other companies going on. And what happened is every major economy in the world has steel and aluminum production as the base of its industrial supply chains. Europe, Japan, Korea, China all made sure they have those industries. We're the only ones among the major steel producing economies that let in a flood of imports. The EU didn't, Canada didn't, Japan didn't. They were protectionist, although they were preaching free trade. And now they're scrambling not to be the new country that absorbs China's overcapacity by adding tariffs. And in fact, India is the one that's now absorbing China's overcapacity. And watch, they're going to put tariffs up, so they're not the one either. So the other countries were Trumpian before Trump was, or before the U.S. was.
Yeah, what's good for the goose, good for the gander. And so is it advisable to protect emerging industries with tariffs? Is that really beneficial to the economy?
Well, sure, and you can get it wrong, but, you know, we've got you have the long view. And you know, with Hamilton and the rest, getting pre-competitive industries is really what it is. You have an invention, you have, you know, testing, you have getting to scale, you get commercialization, and, you know, commercialization, then getting to scale. So some of these pre-competitive industries of the future can't make it unless they have a long enough runway to take off. Japan did it with robotics and many things. They have their industrial strategy with MITI, the Ministry of Industry, Trade, and you know, something else, MIT, TI, Korea. So there, again, you can screw it up, but helping pre-competitive industries of the future that produce a lot of future jobs, supply chains, and innovation, in my view, is worth it.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the whole concept, though, of free trade, yeah, to somewhat it goes back to Adam Smith, but what about the deficit? All of these other countries now are going to see their economic activity presumably go down, or their exports are to the U.S. are going to be diminished somewhat. What kind of problems is this going to create around the world?
Well, first of all, free trade doesn't exist. It can't exist. It can never exist unless you have a world global government with a common currency, common labor market, common banking system. We have free trade within the U.S. states, but you just low tariffs are not free trade. So free trade isn't even a helpful concept, I'd say. Number two, with the U.S. absorbing all the global overcapacity, so every other countries are getting to full employment on the backs of the U.S. consumer. That's even under, you know, current economic theory, these persistent imbalances where one country relies on another's consumers for a long time is not a good thing. Even the IMF and the Treasury Department, U.S. Treasury Department, agree on that. So China is going to have to rely more on its own consumers to eat its overcapacity, to eat its production. Germany needs to rely more on its own consumers to eat its overproduction and not rely on others' consumers. So you got to get the balance right. Exports and imports, roughly within margins, fluctuating in balance.
Mm-hmm. So it's going to self-equilibrate, in other words.
It's supposed to, but it doesn't without intervention. And that's what intervention really should do. But then, again, we've got China, which is totally predatory, and they're a geopolitical rival that wants to dominate the world stage. That's what, you know, a lot of the macroeconomists don't think about, that we don't want a dystopian future world dominated by China who doesn't share our values.
Yeah, well, China, nothing is about the individual. It's all about the state. I mean, you just think back to what Mao said, that one person dies, it's a tragedy. A million people die, and it's a statistic. And that kind of sums up their attitude towards things, doesn't it?
Right. And, you know, 30 years ago, would we have allowed the Soviet Union to get rich on the U.S. consumer market so that they could increase in their economic and military strength? No. And that's what's pretty fundamental now that we're recognizing that China is a strategic competitor. We don't want to assist their their geopolitical rise, their military rise, their military adventurism in the South China and East China Seas, their their plans for the future, which President Xi has made quite clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the U.S. is going to confront China. Is this the kind of thing that potentially leads to war?
I don't think so. I don't think so. There's no correlation between, you know, trading and war. Countries that have traded have gone to war. Countries that haven't have not. So what is creating the potential for war is our funding of the Chinese military. When you've seen war in history is when a recognized superpower is diminishing and another one or more rivals is trying to take its place, and then there's conflict as the superpower status could, you know, the baton changes, and we're funding the point where the baton could change. And if we're okay with that, let's keep going the way we were. If not, let's head it off.
Yeah, and Trump is the only one to ever take recognition of these facts and actually attempt to do something about it. Now, the Chinese have infiltrated our political system. There's so many past former politicians like Boehner who are just totally on the Chinese dole. So he's really up against a lot to try to stop this.
Right. And we're seeing other countries do the same thing. They're curtailing Chinese influence in their domestic political system, like Australia and others. The National Defense Authorization Bill, which is passed, and it's denying funds now to American universities that host Confucius Institutes, which are institutes within the U.S. universities that are controlled by the Chinese government and preach the Chinese government line. Now we're denying funding to them. That's a big, there's over 100 of them around the country. Can you imagine China allowing U.S. Voice of America or, you know, Hamilton Jefferson Institutes in their state universities? It wouldn't happen.
Yeah, I think not. I think not. So we're on the right path. What about our, well, it, by the way, we didn't discuss that looks like U.S. and Mexico, most unlikely agreement that you thought possible, looks like we're just minutes, hours, perhaps minutes away from a major trade agreement. And it's hinging on the domestic content rule for autos and other goods sold, which means that you can't just become a transshipment point or act as a transshipment point for Chinese goods. And the U.S. has said, we'll give you 5 years, maybe it's 3 years. They were negotiating that point for when those rules kick in, or maybe they're going to be graduated over time. What's your take on what's happening with Mexico? Did you ever believe this was going to happen?
I ebbed and flowed over the last year, and we still are not sure it's going to happen. I'm not as convinced that it'll happen as others, but I could, you know, I'm not predicting that it won't happen. But a year ago, I thought a NAFTA renegotiation would probably happen. 3-4 months ago, I thought it probably wouldn't. The president did say in a Reuters interview a couple of days ago that he's in no hurry. Everyone else seems to be in a hurry in the media and the Congress. He's not. I'm withholding judgment until I see what comes out of it.
Yeah, but it's pretty hopeful at this point, isn't it?
Well, it is. I guess hopeful isn't the word I'd use, because my view is that the trade agreements are in many cases a distraction, the distraction from what using our own sovereignty, our own laws, our own conditioning imports upon playing nice, upon not subsidizing, upon not manipulating your currency, not violating human rights. We can do that and have a massive impact, as we've seen in the last 5 months, just by setting the rules of getting into our market. And trade agreements give up some of that sovereignty. So I'm not totally convinced.
Yeah. So, well, hey, we'll see what happens. But and then we have Canada, our good friends to the north. Really, what's going on there? Are they going to be forced to go along in the final analysis?
They may. They're a big country geographically. They're not very big with population, but their exports and imports are relatively in balance. They need the U.S. more than we need them.
Mm-hmm.
Trudeau, he'll make some noise. He's actually getting a popularity boost by pushing back against Trump. So they've got their own kind of nationalism, rah-rah Canada going on. But when the tariffs went up against Chinese steel and aluminum, and Canada was a circumvention point where the Chinese steel came through into the U.S., now he's putting up tariffs because they don't want to absorb all that overcapacity. They're protecting their steel industry. They've protected their wheat growers. They've protected their dairy farmers. And actually, that's not a bad idea. To do. We either do it ourselves or else they shouldn't do it, one or the other.
Mm-hmm. I see your point there. Makes sense. And so what about the EU? They kind of caved once Trump really put it to them, didn't they?
They did. You know, the EU is really unstable in a way. I mean, Germany just came out that Germany has the biggest trade surplus in the world. Last year and this year, Germany is the China of the EU. They're the ones that are overproducing and flooding the peripheral EU countries with goods and taking out their employment in the so-called pigs countries, Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain. And I'm going to be in Frankfurt, telling Germany that they're a passive currency manipulator. And if the Eurozone fails, it's going to be their fault. I told them that in Berlin in May. They've asked me back to Frankfurt in September. And they are. It's not the so-called populists that are at fault. It's Germany with their, domination of Europe and making everybody else poor in the common currency zone.
Yeah. So how long is that going to go on for? Is the EU and most importantly the euro, because that's the tool by which they accomplish what's happening there, domination. Can that go on much longer before these other countries say no more?
I think they've got a maximum of 20 years. The Eurozone has a choice of either going to a full nation state with a common, just like the United States, right, with a common currency, banking system, common fiscal policy, a common regulatory and labor market. They have to go all in, or they have to break up into separate states with their own currencies. I don't think there's anything in the middle, and there's no, of course, taste for going to full nation state status in the EU right now. So I'd bet my donut right now that within 20 years, the EU will have to break up and Germany will be the cause.
Yeah, and Milton Friedman predicted it a long, long time ago, didn't he?
He did. You know, as the EU adds poor countries, it drags the euro value down. But Germany is a strong economy hiding behind a weak euro. So they are a massive trade surplus, massive over exporter, relying on the pigs countries in the U.S. and growing their economy, full employment at the expense of everybody else. And they can't just keep lurching from bailout to bailout. It's been a good deal for Germany, but not the rest of them.
Yeah, well, I guess we're going to see what happens next there. Hey, anyways, where do we find out more about what you're doing here, Mike?
Prosperousamerica.org.
All right. Hey, and we'll have a link to it in the show notes. By the way, be a part of the show. Questions, comments, we read them all. A little bit behind now, but we're catching up. And its email address is kl@carrielutz.com, Twitter feed @CarrieLutz, and Facebook page Financial Survival Network. Michael, always great having you on. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here, Carrie.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.